Just take one thing and do that nicely. In a transcendental way of humility to help access proper shelter of the holy name. So we spent some time after that describing what is upadhi. And in ISKCON, we know that word because it's repeated over and over again. Sarva upadhi. Vinir muktam. Vinir muktam means beyond upadhis, beyond, going beyond, rejecting, transcending. So we spent some time discussing what that is. And then we did a little experiment at the end, or exercise, of when chanting the holy name, so we just chanted japa together for a while, and watch your mind. Does the mind go to the name, or does the mind go to all those other things? And we all know what happens. Because we're very heavily invested in all those other things as what's important to us. Really simple principle. Your attention goes to what's important to you. Really simple principle. The house is on fire. The father rushes into the house, risks his life to save the child that's in the house because the house is on fire. More important than his life is the safety of his child. Or the miser and his money. Or whatever it is that's important to you. Where does the mind go at the time of death? What's important to you? Just a little anecdotal story. For years, as an enthusiastic brahmachari, I was engaged in distributing books, and one of the places I went to distribute books was John F. Kennedy Airport. It wasn't legal, so I had to sneak around, distribute books that way. It was fun. And there were others that went, and then others stopped going, and so it got to the point where I went alone, just because I was committed. And the way that I got there was taking the F train to the A train to the Q10 bus to get there. It took like an hour and a half to get there and an hour and a half to get back. So one evening going back, I left at 8:30 and it was at night. And I was getting off the A train to get to the F train. You had to cross the platform. And there was a man lying on the platform, apparently dying. And there was, you know what happens when somebody's dying, there's a crowd of people around the man that was dying. And the people, somebody said, "Hey man, is there something that you want before you leave?" And he said, "Can I have a cigarette?" Give the guy a cigarette. And he was so out of it, he couldn't even lift his hand to puff the cigarette. So someone put the cigarette to his mouth and puff the cigarette. "Anything else you want?" "I want Susie." And he left his body. Cigarette and Susie. Who knows where that soul went? But the mind goes to what you're attached to. So we had some discussion about the mind has a tendency to go to other things. And one of the questions that was asked, I've been thinking about the question since the question was asked, some thoughts come and go, and we're not so attached to them. And other thoughts stick, and they stick because there's some emotion connected to that thought. So why is there some that emotion is connected? Because it's important to us. Step back from what's important to us, and then you look at the bigger picture of reality with a capital R, or truth with a capital T. All of this is temporal. What's enduring? So we're attached to the temporary, and because we're attached to the temporary, it's important to us, so our thoughts go there, and they get stuck. And it's the cause of offense. You know that word that we talk about sometimes in the Hare Krishna movement, really don't take too seriously. unfortunately, because it's an offense to be inattentive while chanting or maintain material attachments even after understanding so many instructions in the matter. And we maintain material attachments. It's one of the 10 offenses. And so our attention goes elsewhere. We're inattentive while chanting because our thoughts are absorbed in what's important to us. In Shikshastakam, so for those of you that weren't with us yesterday, try in the course of today, if you have more rounds to chant, sit down, put your hand in your bead bag, chant the holy name and watch where your mind goes. And try to withdraw your mind from those upadis that have nothing to do with the eternal soul's eternal relationship with Krishna. And then ask yourself, why am I doing that? And how long am I doing, and how long am I going to continue doing that? According to Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, millions of lifetimes you can continue doing that and not get the benefit. So, is there an alternative? Yes. Look at your value system. And what's eternal? It doesn't mean you dismiss everything and everybody else, you become a Mayavadi. But you see those other, we're going to hear in Lord Brahma's prayers, how you see those other things in relation to Krishna. And do those things in relation to Krishna with attachment to Krishna for the purpose of facilitating attachment to Krishna. That's bhakti. At least that's the karma yoga element of bhakti. And it goes beyond that. So we'll hear this morning. Sankalpa. What is your intention when, with life, or when you put your hand in your beanbag and start chanting? What is your intention? An element of intention to keep that focus, if it's a spiritual intention, is this Shuddha Buddhi prayer, one of the separating apart the affinity for matter that we have so that we can focus on affinity for Krishna. There's so many ways of saying the same thing. Asat Krishna, thirst for the temporary. We set that over here and it becomes Krishna Krishna, thirst for Krishna. And cultivate. And it grows if you cultivate. That's bhakti. It's the cultivation of bhakti. So that was yesterday evening. Now, this morning, and then again this evening, I wanted to take another approach to the principle of humility by appreciating the prayers of Lord Brahma, Canto 10, Chapter 14. So before entering into, because there's a very powerful series of expressions of humility, one after the next, that will help us take the position, if we hear properly, it'll help us to take the position of before Krishna we're very tiny and we should take his full shelter rather than in the temporary. So it's just before we hear, it's a Vedic principle. Before we hear from somebody, we should offer some words of appreciation about that somebody, open our heart to that somebody so the words will go in. So that's what we're going to do first. There's a nice image of Lord Brahma. We'll say some of the unlimited things about Lord Brahma. He's the preceptor, the original preceptor of our sampradaya. He's the first born living being in the whole of the cosmic manifestation. In order to achieve or to be placed in the position of Lord Brahma, it is said that one prerequisite is 100 lifetimes of flawless execution of the duties of life. Try to do it for one day. Try to do it for 1 hour. 100 lifetimes. And if that there isn't such a qualified person, it's such an important post, Krishna himself takes that position. Very qualified individual. And he followed a process where he didn't have sadhu sangha. There were no sadhus to associate with. In fact, all there was darkness in all directions. He couldn't, you know, have a conversation. Hey, Prabhuji, did you read Bhagavad Gita today? Share with me your realizations. There wasn't a Bhagavad Gita. There wasn't any Prabhuji. There was darkness in all directions. And his process of achieving perfection is the same as our process. It was tapa, but his tapa was chanting of mantra. And the chanting of mantra, specifically Brahma Samhita describes two, which devotees who are brahminically initiated also receive in disciplic succession. Gayatri mantra, first one was from the prototype Saraswati, the internal potency of the Supreme Lord Saraswati. He received Gopal mantra, which he chanted for a long, long time. And then, as you see this nice painting, he heard the flute song of Krishna entered in his ears and came out as Kam Gayatri. He chanted that for a long time. And at the end of chanting that for a long time, he not only understood, I'm Krishna's eternal servant, he understood his rasa with Krishna, at least in part, or initially, directionally. He understood our Lord Brahma, understood that he is a maidservant of Krishna. That was his eternal rasa. He still hasn't done creation. He's going to do creation. Then he became well acquainted with the ocean of truth, and he offered these beautiful prayers of Brahma Samhita. And then in turn he manifested, he's the one that the Supreme Lord chose to manifest the Vedas. Because the Vedas are co-eternal with Krishna or Narayana. And he manifested them through Lord Brahma for this world. And then through Lord Brahma he manifested the rishis and the Prajapatis and the demigods and you name it. And how intelligent is Lord Brahma? It's unfathomable. Just take two examples, micro and macro. I understand somewhere outside in southerly direction from Houston, there's a NASA project. Yes? Some of you may be employees of that. So, fantastic amount of intellect goes into sending whatever NASA does, sending things into space that does things. And a whole team of scientists required to put one of those together. But what that thing that's zooming around in space is examining what Brahma creates. He's created the space and everything that's filled that space. That the Hubble telescopes that are zooming around in those spacecraft take pictures of. That's on the macro scale. And then the micro scale, keep going further. From micro, in our Chicago congregation, there's a professor of nanotechnology. There's microtechnology and he's nanotechnology. I don't know exactly what that means. I just know it's smaller than micro. But whatever the nanotechnology chairman of the department knows, who created that which he knows? Like, you know, RNA and DNA, and, you know, the description of the volume of information that's stored in RNA and DNA. So, how much volume of information is stored in a computer? So brilliant people that work for Microsoft or other, you know, Apple, that store information, or the capacity to store information, according to the founder of Microsoft, it's unfathomable the amount of information that's stored in RNA and DNA, and it had to be done by an intelligent person. It's not just by accident. We don't make computers by accident. And that person is Lord Brahma. Nanotechnology and microtechnology. And he received the teaching how to do that directly from Krishna. He knows everything about in this world there is to know. And then manifests that knowledge in the form of the Vedas. He's up there. He's way up there. And Lord Brahma is going to reveal the humility that he feels being before Krishna, which will help us. If we listen carefully, I'll encourage you, not only in the course of this discussion, but in your Krishna conscious life. There are different ways that you can hear and study the message of Scripture. One is information gathering, so that you know more. You can get an A in your exam, or you can say something interesting in the course of speaking to people about Krishna consciousness. That's one way. We all know what that way is. We learned it in school, and we've very practiced at it, and we do it all the time. There's another way where there's profound instruction that is meant to help us introspect and understand how we can come closer to Krishna. And that includes go beyond the covering, we'll use the word again, upadis, the designations, the misconceptions of self rooted in false ego, so that we can chant the holy name without offense. Because that's the only way that we're going to cut through the coverings and go back to Godhead. Offenseless chanting. That's our objective. Become situated in an unobstructed relationship with Krishna. So, hear the message of Lord Brahma in that mood. So how you can apply it in terms of your own humility. I'm especially going to pay attention to 10.14.8. But so we will start with going inside the heart of Lord Brahma in hearing these prayers. He's disclosing his heart to Krishna face to face. And it's recorded for us. Not the audio recording, but another one. Transcribed recording. And before we go to chapter 14, we're going to quickly discuss chapter 13, because it leads into chapter 14, the pastime. This awesomely intelligent, brilliant, perfected being, Lord Brahma, is on his knees before Krishna, who was very small. How many years old was Krishna when this Leela took place? He is still with calves, so it's like 4 years old. Think of somebody you know that's 4 years old, and there's Lord Brahma on his knees before that person. He's going to reveal his realizations about Krishna. So, Krishna, he began herding the calves when he was three. Most boys would begin the family activity when they're five. Brahmanas go to school, and Krishna was precocious. He started taking care of the calves when he was three. Think of somebody that's 3 years old and taking care of. How many calves does Nanda Maharaj have? Asankhyataha is what the Bhagavatam says. Too many to count. There was some limit, but too many, so many. And this painting is from Brihat Bhagavatamrita. One morning, Balaram stayed back. Doesn't give the reason. And Krishna, of course, Balaram is shown in the painting, but on this particular day, that the Brahma Vimoha Lila took place purposefully by design. Balaram wasn't there. There's this wonderful description, I invite you to read it, where Mother Jasoda's affection for Krishna is overflowing. It's time for Krishna to leave. He's been woken and bathed and fed and clothed and ornamented and pampered and loved by Mother Jasoda and her assistants. And now it's time to go. The cowherd boys are clamoring, let's go. They want to be with Krishna. Because there's a special rasa of friendship, of being with the calves and the cowherd boys and Krishna. But Mother Jasoda has her vatsalya rasa and it's interfering with their rasa. Or it's delaying. So she, Krishna's, you know, waving goodbye. And Mother Jasoda runs forward and adjusts his garland and smiles. Krishna nods, I have to go now, Mother, and takes another couple of steps. And Mother Jasoda runs up and puts an extra kachori and samosa in his lunch bag and smiles, and Krishna smiles and says, I have to go now, and takes a few steps. And Mother Jasoda runs up and tells Balaram, this boy is too mischievous. You stay by his side all the time. He listens to you. Please give your protection to him. Yes, Mother, we have to go now. And this goes on and on and on and on. And finally Krishna goes. And when he goes, he's taking care of the calves with all the cowherd boys as their family occupation. Remember, he's 4 years old here. So what do little boys do? Little boys play. That's what little boys do. The Bhagavatam describes at length the types of playful activities the little boys would do, just like little boys do. Or little boys do like what Krishna as the little boy does. That way. And so the painting shows sometimes they would take a posture like a peacock spreading his feathers, or like a frog poised to jump, or like a bird that's ready to fly, making the sounds of the forest animals. Sometimes, this is a painting of Krishna stealing the lunch bag of Madhu Mangal and then running, and Madhu Mangal protests and runs after Krishna, and Krishna tosses the lunch bag to another boy. Madhu Mangal comes running after the other boy, and they pass the lunch bag to another boy, and Madhu Mangal says, I'm a Brahmin, I'll curse you, you can't steal the property of a Brahmana. What are you doing? And behaving just like little children will do. Sometimes Krishna sits beneath a tree and plays upon his flute. And in a very relaxed position, the boys practically forget everything, even the calves. But the calves are with their ears perked listening to Krishna's flute too. Because they're just attached to Krishna. Wherever Krishna, the acharyas describe, Krishna didn't really herd the calves. They just played. And the calves followed them because they're attached to Krishna. That's what they did all day long, day after day. So on one particular day, on the path that they would travel regularly, they saw this humongous creature. It looked like a cave. And the boys said to each other, we've never seen a cave here before. What's that? Let's go explore. Curiosity. So as they got closer, they could feel this heat coming from the inside of the cave and this bad fishy smell coming from the inside of the cave. And they, by deductive logic, reached the conclusion, this isn't a cave. This is a giant serpent lying in the road. But anyway, Krishna is always protected. Let's go explore inside the mouth of the giant serpent. And you see the cowherd boys parading inside the mouth of the giant serpent. Krishna looking on, the Bhagavatam describes, that Krishna wanted to advise the boys, don't go. And his reason for advising them to not go is not just they may die if they enter into the mouth of Agasura, because Krishna would protect them from that. Radha Nila Madhava Kintai. His concern was, he knows how attached the cowherd boys are to him. They can't bear one moment of separation from Krishna. There's a description sometimes when they're going through the forest, there's a tree. And Krishna's on this side of the tree and the cowherd boy's on that side of the tree. For a moment, they don't see Krishna. And that moment seems like 12 years or more of separation from Krishna. And then they see Krishna. Oh. Like the gopis, they have that attachment. The cowherd boys have that attachment. Because they don't have upadis. They only have Krishna. They only have Krishna. Everything that they do is Krishna, Krishna. So Krishna, for his own pleasure, became influenced by his own yogamaya potency and he became bewildered. Feeling concern for the separation the cowherd boys may feel from him. But then by his own icha shakti, that yogamaya potency was withdrawn and Krishna knew what to do. Just pastime. So what did Krishna do? Krishna entered into the mouth of Agasura, which was just what he wanted. The mouth of Agasura closed. And what did Krishna do? He expanded himself bigger and bigger because he's Yogeshwara. He's the master of all mystic power. So he became bigger and bigger and bigger. And the body of Agasura was expanding and expanding. But Krishna was bigger than he could expand. And Agasura suffocated. And the soul of Agasura left his body, hovered in the air. Krishna and the cowherd boys left the body of Agasura and the soul of Agasura hovered in the air, at least the luminous presence of the soul, and entered into Krishna's body, Sayuja Mukti. And the cowherd boys said, "Wow, that was really good. Time for lunch." Acharyas say, each day around, Prabhupada comments, each day around 11 o'clock, a demon would come. And then Krishna would kill the demon. That was the sign it was time for lunch. And the demon came, and again in the afternoon, because they were so absorbed in playing, they wouldn't even have had their lunch if there hadn't been some interlude. So the killing of, we have principal demons that we hear about in the Bhagavatam, but there's every day, 11 o'clock, right on schedule, a demon would come, or more or less, and then it was lunchtime. So the cowherd boys gathered together to have lunch. And on that particular day, Brahma had gone to visit Krishna, at least to see the enactment of Krishna's pastimes. And he saw the whole situation of the deliverance of Agasura. And then after the deliverance of Agasura, he saw the cowherd boys behaving like this, just like children. So he was puzzled. And it's the kind of puzzlement that we should understand. It's something like an arrangement of Krishna, like Arjuna becoming bewildered about his position and Krishna's position for Krishna's purpose, to educate us through Bhagavad Gita, in this case, have the absolute truth, Krishna, become known by Lord Brahma and by us. It's not that he didn't know. He already knew, even before the creation. So the Bhagavatam describes like this, chapter 13. O Maharaj Parikshit, Brahma, who resides in the higher planetary system in the sky, had observed the activities of the most powerful Krishna in killing and delivering Agasura, and he was astonished. Now, the same Brahma wanted to show some of his own power and see the power of Krishna, who was engaged in his childhood pastimes, playing as if with ordinary cowherd boys. Therefore, in Krishna's absence, Brahma took all the boys and calves to another place. Thus, he became entangled. In the very near future, he would see how powerful Krishna was. So, that's the scene. And as the cowherd boys were having their lunch, naturally the calves started to graze here and there looking for fresh grasses. And Lord Brahma swooped in and gathered up the calves and put them in a cave. And then the cowherd boys noticed, oh, the calves have gone somewhere. We should go find them. We're cowherds. We have to protect the calves. And Krishna said, you finish your lunch. I'll go find the calves and bring them back. So Krishna went. Brahma swooped in and took the cowherd boys and put the cowherd boys in the cave. As you see. And then he went back to the scene of the crime, like criminals will sometimes do, to see now what's Krishna going to do. And he was thinking, he's so attached to these cowherd boys. Maybe he'll cry. Maybe when he sees me, he'll fall at my feet and plead with me to please help me find the calves and the cowherd boys. I'm too much attached. What's Krishna going to do? I've got this power. Let's see what Krishna's going to do. What's his power? What's the extent of Krishna's power? Much to his amazement, when he went back, there's Brahma up in the sky in his swan carrier. He saw the calves and the cowherd boys having lunch. He became bewildered. So he went back to the cave, and they were in the cave. Then he went back to the place where they're having lunch, and they're having lunch. What's going on? And then, mystically, the cowherd boys didn't disappear, but the cowherd boys, each and every one of them, manifested four-armed Narayana forms. And not only four-armed Narayana forms, but all the potencies of Narayana for each one of the Narayana forms. The Bhagavatam says, all the Vishnumurtis were surrounded by opulences, headed by Anima Siddhi, by mystic potencies, headed by Aja, and by the 24 elements of the creation of the material world, headed by the Mahatattva. Now, Brahma deals with all these things. He has mystic powers. He has special potencies. He knows all about the 24 elements. He works with them. But they're Krishna's potencies, and Krishna showed that. Just in case we might get a little proud and forget the position of humility. Those of you that know from the Canto 2, Chapter 9, the scene where Brahma is brought before the personality of Godhead, Lord Vishnu, before the creation. And Lord Vishnu says, please ask some benediction. Brahma's clever, he asked for more than one. He asked for, please protect me from pride. Please keep me always in the humble position, because I may think, I'm the creator, I'm the greatest. It's easy to think like that, even for little things. We're proud of some little thing. Prabhupada taught, even a pauper is proud of his penny. Tells a story when he was a young boy with his father going from Calcutta to Rathiatra in Puri. So one of the stops, the train stopped for a while, so Prabhupada, little boy, got off the train, and he saw this poor couple with a tattered cloth taking gathered discarded pieces of wood and very carefully moving from one side of the cloth to the other side of the cloth, counting their pieces of wood. And Prabhupada said, from that experience, I could then understand, even a pauper is proud of his penny. So whoever we are, the tendency for pride is very strong. And it eclipses humility. So humility is, you can be the recipient of these things, some part of it, or, you know, a lesser or greater, but the credit goes to the person from whom they have come. So Brahma's getting this realization. Then Lord Brahma saw that kala, swabhava, sanskara, kama, karma, and the gunas, their own independence being completely subordinate to the potency of the Lord, had all taken forms and were worshipping these Vishnumurtis, like a big crescendo, a cacophony of glorifications. There's a phrase, the opulence that Brahma saw was inconceivable. Atarkya, beyond reason, beyond logic, just inconceivable. Nija, mahimani. Brahma fell to the ground, practically fainted, paying his obeisances to Krishna. Stood up again, looked again into the same scene and fell to the ground again. And stood up again and fell to the ground again. And then the next thing, all those Narayana forms disappeared, all the cowherd boys disappeared, all the calves disappeared, and it was just that scene that we see of Krishna standing beneath a tree with a lump of fruit and yogurt in his left hand, holding his flute in his right hand, smiling with unblinking eyes, looking at Lord Brahma. That's the scene. And remember who Lord Brahma is. He's not just an ordinary fellow. Most intelligent being in the whole universe that fully understands all these other things. But Krishna's showing him not only those opulences, but a very important part of this message is he's showing his original form. So this first section, we're going to cover two sections. I hope I'll be able to get through it quickly, or within time. How to know the unknowable. Note, that's a contradiction. To know the unknowable is a contradiction of terms. Krishna is unknowable, so how can you know Krishna? Especially with the consideration that his potencies are atarkya mahimani, unlimitedly manifest and inconceivable. Sometimes Krishna doesn't show them, mostly. Sometimes Krishna shows them. Sometimes then Krishna shows them and withdraws them. At his will. Simply by his icha shakti. He just does this and then does that and unlimited. So how is it possible? And the message, the theme, is by humility. We can access the truths of Krishna when there's humility. Of course, humility is essential for developing bhakti. And it's through bhakti that we can understand Krishna. But we can't access bhakti. We'll do mechanical chanting minus bhakti. Even we're doing the chanting. So humility is essential. And then hearing the glories of Krishna coming from the mouths of Lord Brahma will help us appreciate. I did this, and it's not so... Could the lights go down a little bit more? And then you could see a little bit better. I took the trouble of making this color-coded so that the words of the verse could then correspond with the translation. This first verse, it's a darshan. It's like coming before the deity, Radha Nila Madhava, and having their darshan, and he's saying what he's seeing. It's similar to Brahma Samhita, the first of his prayers. It's the form of the Lord. That's the first verse, Chintamani Prakara Sadmasu. the abode of the Lord, the form of the Lord, and the pastimes of the Lord. So here's what he sees. He calls him Idga Te. You are the only worshipable Lord. Abra Vapushe. Your transcendental body is dark blue like a new cloud. Your garment is brilliant like lightning. So it's a nice contrast. Dark body, brilliant like lightning garment. And his face, Lasan Mukaya, is very beautiful. And the opulence of Krishna is not like the opulence of Vaikuntha. It surpasses the opulence of Kuntha. He's more interested in the simple flowers. So he wears a garland of forest flowers and leaves. His earrings are gunja berries. His decoration on his head is a peacock feather. That's this word here, paripicha. Same as in that first verse, barhavatasam asitam buddhasundarangam. He's decorated with a peacock feather. And he has vetra, vishana, and venu. He has a herding stick, a buffalo horn, and a flute. If you look at the painting, they're all there. They're stuck in his belt, around his waist. And he's standing there with a morsel of food in his hand, underneath a tree, smiling. Just saying nothing, just looking. He's showing his original form, his Govinda form. He's shown these other forms, but he's showing his original form from which all the other forms have come, including the cowherd boys and the expansions of the cowherd boys that were an exact likeness of the cowherd boys, so much so even the mothers didn't recognize. Those of you that are mothers, can you imagine not recognizing your own child? Not possible. There may be a look-alike, but you know your own child. Not possible. They didn't know the difference. Even their voice sounded like their own voice. And the calves, same. Krishna was reciprocating with the mothers that wanted Krishna as their son and the cows that wanted to give their milk to Krishna, who became their calf. Krishna became their calf. Why? He's reciprocating with their love. That's Krishna. So, standing before Brahma, after having fallen at his feet many, many times, Brahma falling before Krishna, Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur says, Krishna's wondering, I'm a cowherd boy. Why are you worshipping me? You're Lord Brahma. Lord Brahma literally means that you're the greatest, most powerful, most knowledgeable, all-knowing person in the universe. Why are you offering obeisances to me? This is inappropriate. It's very puzzling. So he goes on with the next. My dear Lord, this is why I'm offering my prayers and obeisances to you. Neither I nor anyone else can estimate the potency of this transcendental body of yours. It's already been described. Unlimited, inconceivable, beyond even Brahma's capacity. Neither I nor anyone else can estimate the potency of this transcendental body of yours, which has shown such mercy to me, and which appears just to fulfill the desires of your pure devotees. So that's this. The commentary of Acharyas focuses a lot on this. Sva Icha Mayasya. Krishna shows his form by his own Icha, his own will. So how does this apply to chanting? The name of Krishna is none different than Krishna, and we're chanting mechanically. If we want Krishna to show himself as his form. It's not just a philosophical adjustment that the name of Krishna is not different than Krishna. It's the quality with which we chant. The sankalpa, the intention of being in our relationship with Krishna through the medium of associating with Krishna through his holy name. If we don't do that, it will remain mechanical. If we do that, Krishna will reveal himself. And in his own way, tomorrow when we have our 64 round day, may you have some moments like that where Krishna is revealing himself to you. But please understand, it's not based upon your own effort. We must make some effort, but behind the effort is the sense of just being in your relationship with Krishna. I shared this with one devotee yesterday. In January, we had a japa retreat like this. One man attended. It was after the 64 round day. It was Sunday evening. And he wanted to share something with me. I didn't know the person. He said, I've been coming to the temple for 15 years. And I haven't really made so much spiritual progress. And at most, I've been chanting 8 rounds a day for some time. Mostly mechanical. There have been opportunities to go to japa retreats. I really haven't gone because I guess it's complacency or whatever. And they were too far away. And so this one was close by. I thought, okay, I'll go because it's close by. That was like, you know, lukewarm. And then, you know, I heard these nice things about chanting without upadis and this and that. And I thought, well, let me give it a try. I don't know how many rounds I'll be able to chant. Lukewarm. And then, so the 64 round day, and I sat down and 16 rounds went, it was really easy. Okay, I'll chant another 16 rounds, see what happens. And something happened, he described. I felt like I was floating. I felt levity and lightness and like a cork on water, just floating and moving, and it was mystical. Then I thought, let me do some more of this. So the next 16 rounds, and somewhere through those next 16 rounds, I started getting attached to the experience, and it went away. False ego got in the way. The doership got in the way. So then, but I tried and I tried and I tried and it wouldn't come back. So I more or less threw my hands up in the air and said, Krishna, I'm yours. And almost immediately, it happened again. It was amazing. I don't know if I'll ever experience this again in my life. But now I know that Krishna is real. The holy name of Krishna is Krishna, and Krishna just wants to see us be with him, and as we want to be with him instead of being the controller and the doer. I hope I never forget that realization, and I just wanted to share that with you. Wow. So I'm sharing it with you. It's real. The promise of connecting with Krishna is real, but Krishna wants to see from our side certain things. You know, let go of false ego, let go of immodesty, let go of pride, let go of the temporary, and just be in our relationship with Krishna. It doesn't mean you become irresponsible, it means you're Krishna conscious while you're living in the world. Conscious of Krishna while you're living in the world. Is it possible? Not only possible, it's what Krishna wants. And what Krishna wants is certainly possible. It will happen if we just reciprocate with Krishna. So here's Brahma saying, Sva Icha Mayasya, Krishna shows his form. He showed his pastimes form. He showed those unlimited Narayana forms. He withdrew them all and showed his original form. How? To fulfill the desires of his pure devotees. So we have a means, sadhana, to cultivate pure bhakti. And we just try our sincere best to follow that sadhana. So now, although my mind is completely withdrawn from material affairs, ours isn't, our mind, put your hand in your bead bag and start chanting, and the fears of life fill your mind. In Brahma's case, his mind is completely withdrawn from material affairs. Even he cannot understand Krishna's personal form, but Krishna can reveal it. That which is unknowable can be known by revelation or through the medium of bhakti. And then finally, how then is it possible to understand the happiness you experience within yourself? So many things can be said. Again, Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur presents this, the inner reflections of Brahma. I desire to examine the extent of your potency. I desire to understand how you'll react to my showing my power. In turn, you have shown such mercy to me, giving me a glimpse of who you actually are. So, again, our theme, how can one estimate something that is unlimited, which can produce unlimited entities, each having unlimited potencies? And it becomes possible through bhakti. Now he's going to go on the negative side. It's not possible through gyan. Then comes this very important verse. Very important verse. Say it three times. Very important verse. Which Lord Chaitanya accepted as the goal of life. Those who, even while remaining situated in their established social positions, throw away the process of speculative knowledge with their body, mind, and words, that's this jnane prayasam, offer all respects to descriptions of your personality and activities. That's what you do. You don't do is you reject the jnana process and take shelter of the hearing and chanting process of Krishna's personality and activities, like we're doing right now. Dedicating their lives to these narrations, that's deepening that commitment, which are vibrated by you personally and by your pure devotees, certainly conquer your lordship. One of Krishna's names is Ajita, unconquerable. And Brahma is saying, he who is unconquerable becomes conquered by that dedication, that commitment. Who is this a painting of? Lord Chaitanya, and who is he embracing over here? Ramananda Roy. This is, and his, the associates of the king, or the mayor, governor of Madras, his people over there. And over here is Lord Chaitanya's assistant, by the banks of the Kaveri in South India. And Lord Chaitanya met Ramananda Roy at the encouragement of Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya, long description from Chaitanya Charitamrita. They again had their rendezvous in the evening where Lord Chaitanya began the conversation, nice starting point for a conversation. Please describe the goal of life and the means to achieve it. And Ramananda Roy suggested some of our favorite verses of scripture. Sarva dharmam parityaja, or yam yam vapi smaran bhavam chajatante kalevaram. Yat karoshi yadasnasi yad shahosi datasi yat, or a performance of varnashrams. Each time Lord Chaitanya said, no, go further. That's external, go further. This is what Ramananda Roy suggested, pure devotional service without any touch of speculative knowledge, and is the perfection. and rejecting that jnana process, not mixing jnana with bhakti, just bhakti. And what's the result? Well, pure bhakti gives the sense, the realization, not just theoretical, but the realization that everything is connected to Krishna, because he's the source. Just like Lord Brahma was shown by Krishna, all those different forms of the Lord and all those potencies. This is a painting of Hamsa avatar speaking to Lord Brahma, saying essentially the same thing. If we don't see the factual relationship between matter and Krishna, we're not seeing accurately. An essential part of Hamsa avatar's teaching. And here's the way it's stated in the purport, Srila Prabhupada's purport, in this discussion between Ramananda Roy and Mahaprabhu. The Mahabhagavata, the advanced devotee, certainly sees everything mobile and immobile. But he does not exactly see their forms. Rather, everywhere he immediately sees manifest the form of the Supreme Lord. Very similar to the description that we heard yesterday about you don't see the tree, you see Krishna. Remember that from yesterday. So the tree is, that's his designation, is the body. But the Krishna conscious person does not see the tree, but sees Krishna present. Sees the form, but he sees it's resting upon Krishna. It's Krishna's energy and he's the source of everything. You don't see the tree, you see Krishna. I see a tree. But the perfected soul sees the form, but not just the form, it sees resting in Krishna. This is a painting of Sanatan Goswami, who in his commentary on this verse refers to a Shvetashvatara Upanishad verse that says, Tam eva viditva. Freedom is possible only by understanding Brahman. So he raises the question, if that's the case, then how can an ignorant person attain liberation? They're condemned. So as if gyan is the process. You have to be filled with gyan, then you can understand Brahman. And the answer is no. This verse answers that question. Gyan alone cannot achieve that. Bhakti alone can achieve that. Bhakti is higher. That's what this message is saying. By the hearing process, which is glorified in verse 3, we develop such a loving, trusted relationship with Krishna that he will say, I am like this. Sva icha mayasya. You wanted to see me as I am. You wanted to serve me. Such a deep desire for so long. And I have tested you so many times, and you chose only me. Now here I am. Prabhupada spoke the same kind of a message about deity worship. We're focusing on the holy name, but those that engage in deity worship, which is a wonderful companion for the holy name. Prabhupada said, you go faithfully serving the deity as the form of the Lord, and one day the deity will speak to you. And he will say, I am like this. So one day, if we chant the holy name in that way, Krishna may one day, of course it's according to his will, I am like this. We'll see the form of the Lord in the holy name, or the holy name is the form of the Lord. That's the faith we were discussing yesterday evening. Faith is necessary, an operative, essential element of going beyond mechanical chanting and into the realm of pure bhakti, where the upadhi attachment dissolves. So, Brahma goes on, O Krishna, O Ajita, you are conquered by this path. Let me say more about this glorious bhakti process in contrast to jnana. This next verse, these are all very well-known verses, very important verses, often referred to verses. Here's another one. Number 3 and number 8 are especially often repeated. My dear Lord, devotional service unto you is the best path for self-realization. If someone gives up that path and engages in the cultivation of speculative knowledge, he will simply undergo a troublesome process, klishyanti, and will not achieve his desired result. As a person who beats an empty husk of wheat cannot get grain, one who simply speculates cannot achieve self-realization. His only gain is trouble. Kleshala. So this is a metaphor to help us understand. The previous verse was glorifying gyan above, bhakti above gyan. This is the negative. Just do gyan and this is what it's like. There's the wheat and there's the thrashing of the wheat to get the grain. But supposing you continue thrashing where the grain has already been removed, what do you gain? Nothing. Well, trouble. Klishyanti. And misery. Kleshala. But no labhyate. So don't do that. Move to the, although tendency is there, conditioned tendency is there, to try to understand reality, or capital R reality, with our power of intellect. Lord Brahma doesn't advise it. You just get these three things. Trouble, misery, and no understanding of Krishna at the end. Text 5. O Almighty Lord, in the past, many yogis in this world achieved the platform of devotional service by karma yoga, offering all their endeavors unto you and faithfully carrying out their prescribed duties combined with their yoga practice. Through such devotional service perfected by the process of hearing and chanting about you, that's the elevating factor once again mentioned in text 3. Now here it is, text 5 again. They came to understand you, O infallible one, and could easily surrender to you and achieve your supreme abode. So these surrendering things aren't going to happen without humility. Now, Lord Brahma understands the process of gyan, he understands the process of yoga, and he's subordinating them to the process of bhakti, which will not take place without humility. These realizations will not take place without humility. Having Krishna show his form as he showed to Lord Brahma is not going to take place without humility. So he's, from the position of humility, he's sharing his realizations, which if we hear properly, we want to get on that train and go to the destination the train will take you. Text 6. Non-devotees, however, cannot realize you in your full personal feature. What you see in big letters at the bottom is now speaking of the impersonal feature. Nevertheless, it may be possible for them to realize your expansion as the impersonal supreme by cultivating direct perception of the self within the heart. But they can do this only by purifying their mind and senses of all material distinctions. At the bottom it shows avikrityat, which is very similar to upadhi. So even if you're an impersonalist, you have to deal with getting rid of upadhis. If you're personalist, you have to get rid of identifying with the upadhis. But the bhakti power enables you to do that fully and then realize the personal feature, the reciprocation of Krishna, and attachment to all material sense objects. Only in this way is your impersonal feature manifest itself to them. It's an inferior or a lesser state of fullness. But still some of those same elements must be there. Text Text 7. In time, learned philosophers or scientists may be able to count all the atoms of the earth, the particles of snow, or perhaps even the shimmering molecules radiating from the sun, the stars, and other luminaries. But among these learned men who could possibly count the unlimited transcendental qualities possessed by you, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, who have descended onto the surface of the earth for the benefit of all living entities. One time I was visiting in Seattle, and to get from the airport to the place where I was staying, we passed by a big mountain. There's several big mountains in the Seattle area. And I was asking, what's the name of that mountain, and how much snow on the cap of the mountain year-round? And the devotee just started going into, you know, the number of feet of snow that mountain alone gets, beside from any other place that gets snow. And I was thinking of this verse. Supposing somebody could count all the particles of snow on that mountain, what to speak of all the snow anywhere? Supposing somebody can do that, they will be unable to know the unlimitedness of Krishna. Our acharyas speak of Ananta Shesh, who is an expansion of Sankarshan. He's lying at the bottom of the universe, and from his mouths, which the unlimited glories of the Lord are being chanted, and he finds no end to them. And that's Sankarshan, what to speak of us. So how do we know that unlimited person who has unlimited expansions, each of which with unlimited potencies? By the bhakti process. And very mercifully, that Supreme Person can disclose himself to us. And for us, the most powerful and recommended access is through the holy name, for which we have no attraction. So humility is essential. And it's a deep, profound kind of humility that Brahma has. And here's another, this is a very beautiful painting of Uddhava offering some prayers to Krishna, or hearing from Krishna. And after hearing from Krishna, he speaks this wonderful verse, a whole bhakti, where he's appreciating to Maitreya. In this painting, is Maitreya is also hearing this discussion between Krishna and Uddhava. When Vidura comes into that same situation after Krishna departs, never to be seen again by Uddhava or anyone in this worldly pastimes, Uddhava's glorification of Krishna is this, just even this one quality of mercy. It's unlimited. And what is that unlimitedness? The unlimitedness is Putana, who came to kill Krishna, but she came in the role or disguise as a mother. He accepted that motherly affection and gave her a position in the spiritual world as an associate of Mother Jasoda eternally. So, how shall I take shelter of one more merciful? What's the limit of the mercifulness of Krishna? And in this same Canto 10, Chapter 14, Brahma says the same thing. You already arranged to give yourself to Putana and her family members. And the Sanskrit phrase is Sakula, along with her family members. Did you know that Putana had two brothers? Same family. After Putana was killed, the two brothers wanted to take revenge. One of them was Bakasura and the other was Agasura. Nice family. But Krishna is so kind, he gave himself to all three of them. in exchange for her disguising herself as a devotee. So what is left for you to give to these devotees of Vrindavan, whose very lives and hearts are dedicated only to you? He's glorifying the residents of Vrindavan, but he's also expressing the unlimitedness of Krishna's capacity for mercy. How fortunate are the residents of Vrindavan? Here's how he gave himself to Bakasura. Bakasura wanted to swallow Krishna. So Krishna allowed himself, as you see on the left side, to enter into Bakasura's beak. He touched it, the inside of his yucky mouth. But he made it so that Bakasura couldn't swallow him. He tried to swallow him, but he couldn't swallow him. And then Krishna expanded his body, stepped out, bifurcated the beaks of Bakasura and killed him. But he gave, before that, there's the cowherd boys assisting with their sticks, just in case Krishna needed some help. But he gave himself to Bakasura. And he gave himself to Agasura. He entered into Agasura's mouth. When Krishna entered the mouth of Agasura, the demigods, hidden behind the clouds, exclaimed, "Alas, alas!" But the friends of Agasura, like Kamsa and other demons, were jubilant. But Krishna gave his mercy, entering into his mouth. He gave himself to these terrible personalities. So then, what to speak of the residents of Vrindavan? This is his realization. We're being given by Chaitanya Mahaprabhu the opportunity, the gift, to enter into the mood of the residents of Vrindavan. Just follow him. And the unlimitedness of Krishna's capacity for mercy will be experienced. This beautiful painting shows all five rasas, and I'm looking at my watch and I have to keep moving because we're running out of time. What to speak of the gopis and that intensity of their affection and the reciprocation of Krishna for the intensity of their affection. It's just the nature of Krishna. Brahma declares, you have unlimited qualities and each of them are expandable to an unlimited degree. Yet the impersonalist does not and cannot realize these qualities. They deny that he has qualities. So, I was noticing as coming to the temple room, in the gift shop, there's a large picture book, Form of Beauty. Maybe you've seen. So, I was thinking of this slide. Try to conceive of what unlimitedly beautiful means. How beautiful is unlimitedly beautiful? How attractive is unlimitedly attractive? How compassionate is unlimitedly compassionate? Etc. It's inconceivable. Unlimitedly merciful. So, Brahma is appreciating that feature of Krishna. And text 8, I think I'm going to have to end with this. Let's see how it goes. I now wish to describe both the internal and the external activities of bhakti. Text 8, very, very famous verse. Anybody ever have a tribulation in their life? We all have had tribulation. Keep it in your back pocket. This verse and the message of this verse. Wear it, in fact. Put it in your front pocket. Wear it around your neck, just like along with the Trinadapi Sunichena verse. My dear Lord, one who earnestly, susamikshamano, earnestly is essential. Earnestly is a very important word, like, you know, deeply sincere. Waits for you to bestow your causeless mercy upon him. All the while patiently suffering the reactant of his past misdeeds and offering you respectful obeisances with his heart, words, and body is surely eligible for liberation, for it has become his rightful claim. We could spend 16 classes just on this verse, but I have to go quickly. there's this notion of destiny. People don't like the word karma because it sounds like we lose our free will because things are destined. Things are destined because of our past free will choices. We now have some karma coming our way. So there's this destiny or fate. And people fear the hand of fate. They're like, you know, I'm helpless. If you become a devotee of Krishna, that fate can change. Remember Prabhupada saying one time, Srila Prabhupada, is it something that devotees should do to go to an astrologer and find out what's going to happen? Prabhupada's answer was, if you know it's going to rain, you may carry an umbrella. Interesting answer. Should we check the weather forecast, Prabhupada? Well, you know, we're having a Rath Yatra. You're going to have the Rath Yatra anyways because we scheduled the Rath Yatra. So whether it rains or doesn't rain, you're going to have Rath Yatra. You may carry an umbrella. If you know what your fate or destiny is, you may make some, you know, do something. You may not do that something. But for sure you're going to live your life in devotion to Krishna. For sure, that's for sure. And then, so where does your attention go instead? Your attention goes instead into the shelter of the lotus feet of Krishna. That's what Brahma is saying. Here's some references that help understand that this message. This is down at the bottom here. This is Prithu Maharaj. When Lord Vishnu came and made his appearance at a sacrificial arena that Prithu Maharaj was arranging. And in that verse, one of the verses of that section, he says, as a father, not waiting for the son's demand, does everything for the benefit of the son, please bestow upon me whatever you think is best for me. That's a nice prayer. There's many places where the Supreme Lord appears and said, you please be very much, please take a benediction from me. There's a nice answer. Because he knows what's best for us. And nice example of King Chitaketu, who was cursed by Parvati, and he simply accepted it. It's somehow the plan of the Lord. I don't understand the plan of the Lord, but somehow it's the plan of the Lord, so I accept my destiny. But I will not let my mind budge an inch from the lotus feet of the Supreme Lord and stay fixed in his service. And as a result, he went back to Godhead in that next lifetime. Or Indra made his big offense to curb Indra's pride. The whole Leela was arranged and Indra's pride was taken away. And then he could approach Krishna in the proper mood. Or in nectar devotion, this important message of expecting ashabhanda, hope against hope. The expectation that Krishna is merciful and Krishna will bestow his mercy. Don't get into the counteracting the negativity thing when the thing comes. You may make some practical arrangement, but let your mind not budge an inch from the lotus feet of Krishna, the expecting Krishna to be merciful because he's merciful. And the more you go away from the shelter of Krishna's mercifulness and act in an independent manner, the more you're blocking the flow of that mercy that will come to you. Just some comment of Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur. Vishwanath says, it's very beautiful. He says, my father, he will sometimes give me something very sweet. And sometimes my father will give me something bitter nimba. Sometimes my father will embrace me. Sometimes my father scolds me. But I know my father is loving. He knows what's in my best interest better than I know what's in my best interest. And so I simply accept. Whatever is my best interest, he knows. And I accept that. That's the mood. It's a very important message of humility because you depart from humility And you get into all this other stuff, the false ego stuff, that says, I'm going to counteract this problem, or I'm going to get back at the other person, or, you know, the world of Maya becomes the world that you inhabit, and the world of Krishna is left behind. You may do something practical, but let that practical something be in the thought, in the mood of following some indication of Krishna or the great souls, not, you know, a two-pocket program where I'm going to defend myself or get rid of the problem and, oh, by the way, also think of Krishna. That's a big mistake. The tribulation is an opportunity to take exclusive shelter of Krishna. That's the right way to go. Vishwanath says, the devotee thinks, the Lord certainly knows what is best for me, even if I don't know. Karma and time have no effect on a devotee, so this is Krishna's personal arrangement for me out of his mercy. Krishna sometimes gives me happiness, sometimes gives me distress, considering how to engage me in his service. Just 2 days ago I had this nice discussion with a god brother who is undergoing some tribulation. And he said essentially the same thing. We might design what's going to happen to us differently than what's happening to us. You know, if I was Krishna, I would do it differently. But we're not Krishna, and Krishna is infallible. And he's loving. And he knows what's best to engage me and purify me, and I'm ready for that. Because I will not budge one inch from this meditation on the lotus feet of the Supreme Lord. And finally, we're past our time. You're a very patient audience. Sorry I'm taking too long. Jiva Goswami writes something very, very wonderful, which is so wonderful I want to read it, or parts of it. One does not consider happiness and distress arising from my karma if you're a devotee. One offers respect to you, Krishna, with attachment, using body, mind, and words in order to develop a taste for your topics, which was discussed in text number 5. We're trying to cultivate a taste for the topics of Krishna. Some calamity comes. And what happens, just like the discussion yesterday evening, your attention goes to those thoughts and there's emotions connected to it because it's calamity, because of our attachment. So from the core of your heart, choose another path. Choose the path of accepting Krishna's arrangement because he's kind, and you go forward with what you understand is the hearing and chanting activity, which will cleanse the soul. He then goes into the... I'm skipping parts. He goes into the 10 topics of the Bhagavatam, which are found in Canto 2, the first verse of Chapter 10. And one of them, Ashraya, is the shelter of the other 9. Bhagavan is the shelter, Pade, of Mukti, the 9th item. Sridhar Swami also says that the shelter Krishna of the 10th topic is presented in the 10th canto. You are that devotee's portion when the father divides property among brothers. You get it? There's many brothers and there's one who's just faithful to the father. And when the father divides his property, he may give the property to the other brothers, but he gives himself to the one who's faithful. That devotee receives you, Muktipada, the shelter of liberation, as his share. Subset is liberation, but the devotee doesn't want, wants the father, or the, wants Krishna. Liberation comes. What use is liberation then? Sridhar Swami says, without living as a devotee, the property claimant cannot attain liberation. You want stuff rather than relationship with Krishna. Yeah, change the channel to relationship with Krishna. And then you get stuff and liberation, but most importantly, you get Krishna. Same with the process of chanting. Exactly on the topic of yesterday evening. In this matter, material intelligence is forbidden. But even without speculating, we know that the living son inherits the property. In terms of the verse, the person on the path of bhakti receives the property since he is really living. Otherwise, his breathing is like the breathing of the bellows of a blacksmith. He's not living. The real living is bhakti. And one who's in bhakti receives that relationship with Krishna. So when we're chanting, back to our topic here, when chanting, stay within that relationship with Krishna. It's the most important part of our day, and in the broader picture, the most important part of our life. It's the most important part of anything that we do is how we chant the holy name. Be in your relationship with Krishna. It's not an opportunity to multi-process things because you're feeling a little more peaceful. So you can multi-process a little easier. There's a little more clarity in multi-processing. That's a mistake. Withdraw attention from those things and place attention simply on one thing. And continue to cultivate that. And then the mind can become progressively controlled and the significance of the upadis diminishes. And then like the exercise that we did last evening, some will still remain as, you know, themes that are recurring. The really prominent ones, the ones that were really invested in the temporality. So as the question was last night, what do you do about those? With faith, just as Brahma is saying, you withstand that temptation to go there, and you go to the realm of the eternal, knowing that Krishna will help you reconcile those things, although I may not know how to do that. Krishna knows how to do that. Let me invest my faith in Krishna. And that's the price that you pay for bhakti, for the pure holy name specifically, is faith. Lord Nityananda was told like that by Lord Chaitanya. You can open a franchise for giving the pure holy name, but you have to charge a fair price, Lord Chaitanya said. And that fair price is faith. At least some. It's like distributing books. Give some donation. Well, I can't afford the book. Just give something. Make some so the sacrifice is the sacrifice of faith, withdrawing faith from the temporal and investing faith in Krishna. That his name and himself are none different and he's all merciful. He'll help us. He's very kind. He's most merciful. His mercy is unlimited, although we're very limited. So it's a wonderful process. And it's been given to us freely. Lord Chaitanya says, please take it. But I'm distracted. Please take it anyway. But I'm attached. That's okay. Take it anyway. Please take it. And with it, Brajaprem. I didn't get to finish, but I'm finished. The next several verses, it's Brahma's prayers for forgiveness. We'll do that later. It's 9:15. Any comments or questions? Anyone? A little bit, I think. We could take a couple. Maybe I was talking too long and the lights were out and you've all fallen asleep or something. Yes? Up here, Uttama Bhakta?
Thank you very much, Maharaj. So while a person is chanting in the mood of humility and total dependence on Krishna, is there anything that you suggest in our, you know, the time that 2 hours that we're not chanting, 22 hours, that we need to make some adjustments in those 22 hours so that they also help us when we chant?
Sure.
And those 2 hours help us in those 22 hours.
I'll keep very simple. Two things. The way that we lead our life should be according to theistic conduct. So make our life according to theistic conduct, like the incubation chamber is theistic conduct, according to one's position, according to suitability for one's position. And second is, having chanted in that mood in the morning, or whenever you chant, contemplate the mood. It will stay with you anyway, because as you become attached to something, you think of that something anyway. The romance, the young boy, young girl, and woo, woo, woo. So they don't have to be told to think of each other. They think of each other because there's romance. So if we become attached to that access to Krishna in our relationship with Krishna, the mood will stay with you. But then you contemplate, not like, I wish I had that same mood when chanting when I'm here in the office, but you remember that connection with Krishna, even while you're doing something else besides your, you know, daily chanting. The relationship with Krishna remains vital. And then when interacting with family members who we're attached to, wife and children and stuff, we're attached. And it's natural. So see Krishna there. And, you know, the purpose, the God-given purpose of that arrangement of family is to assist one another in becoming, it's a tool or a medium to become further attached to Krishna. And cultivate that when doing those activities. And you know, it could be elaborated further and further, but those are principles. The purpose of my occupation is not just simply to earn some money so I can pay my bills, and that's a secular conception. There's the worldly part of my life, and then there's what I do for devotion. Not like that. But here's an opportunity that I have my nature due to stuff in the past. I have a body and a mind. I have psychophysical nature. This is suitable for me, this activity. I may not particularly like what I do in the office every day, but it's suited to my nature, and it's an opportunity for me to dedicate this to Krishna, so it brings me closer to Krishna. And as a householder, then I have the means to fulfill my duties, but the bestower is Krishna. It's not my smarts and my savvy and skill and, you know, cleverness and working my way through, you know, the complexities of relationships in the office. It's Krishna is my maintainer. And I'm serving Krishna, and Krishna is maintaining me. It's an opportunity for realize more deeply my relationship with Krishna and serve Krishna in other ways. Taking care of his part and parcel living entities, my family members, being charitable and part of my duty as a grihastha. It's theistic conduct with Krishna at the center. It's a paradigm shift from material to spiritual. But it's certainly possible. And it starts with chanting. And it carries over to theistic conduct in its various forms, depending upon our situation. Yes?
Yes, Maharaj. So, reference to this verse, are the turbulences a result of previous activities or recent activities? And how like we, I know we are running out of time, but still like I was thinking like you can little bit explain this better. So we were talking about turbulences.
Talking about?
Turbulences.
Which?
Turbulences.
Sequence?
Turbulence. Yes.
Oh yeah, turbulence. Our friend. Okay.
So with respect, can we correlate them from the previous activities or karma or free will, whatever, or yeah, the recent ones, so how we can correlate that?
All of the above.
All of the above.
It's complex. And to separate out this and that, it's too complex. Bhaktivinoda Thakur's language is ancient prejudices. Jiva Goswami's language is our anarthas are abundant from many previous lives. So, you know, some of current life and some of our previous lives. And it's not so important, you know, exactly cause and effect. How many lifetimes ago is the cause of today's turbulence? It's tendencies or dispositions. Vasana is the Sanskrit term. It's just like a propensity to be in such and such of a mood. And then because of that, then such and such things happen to come and trigger that mood. And it's all arranged, you know, very complex arrangement to keep us entangled in material existence. Until that point in time comes that, you know, jiveta, in Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur's and Jiva Goswami's commentary, this word jivaita gets a lot of attention. Just live as a devotee, basically. Live a life in devotion. So whatever the wherever's come from, whatever the turbulence is, and the up and the down and sideways, and then coming and going. And sometimes it's quiet and sometimes it's noisy. Jivaita. Stay in that life of devotion. And yo, mukti pade. Krishna will give himself to you. Because that's what we want. Not just the turbulence should subside. We all want to be peaceful. One was sharing, my wish is to be peaceful and happy. But that's not going to happen without being in our relationship with Krishna. Jiveta. We tolerate the other, accepting it. It's coming because of some my past misdeeds, whatever that is, and I accept it. Normally we don't do that. We get, you know, reactive. You don't even have to think about it. Just like someone throws something at you, your hands go up. You don't have to think about it. The arms protect the body. It's reflex. You don't have to go to reflex school. It just happens. And this other is a disposition. You may do something, or you may not do something. But jiveta, mukti pade svadayabhak. You go back to Godhead. So dayabhak means you go back to Godhead. You inherit the property of the Father. What's the property of the Father? The spiritual world. You inherit a situation in the spiritual world. Just by that, not being reactive. You don't have to be passive. You don't have to be an impersonalist. You just be a devotee. Jiveta. Live your life that way. Very valuable instruction. It's not possible if there isn't humility. It's possible if there's humility. It's not possible if there isn't humility. So we get so many lessons to learn how to be humble. Maybe too many. You know, the prescription of medicine is very strong, Dr. Krishna. Very, it's weaker dose, please. But we don't have that option. He knows. Krishna wants us with him. Anyway. We'll end there. Thank you very much. Prabhupada ki jai. Sorry for going over time.